The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
They were the heroes from the future. Teenagers protecting the universe from those that would sow the seeds of chaos. Each had unique powers and abilities. And though they often had their differences, they came together to save the day as the Legion of Superheroes. Now, you can be a part of their adventures and learn the history of the future in the Legion Clubhouse.
This issue of the Legion Clubhouse, we can look at one of two ways. The first way is, hey, it's an issue about Tyrock. And the other way we could look at it is, is this an issue about Tyrock? Let's find out which one it is.
Legion of Superheroes, number 265. The Brigadoon Syndrome, published July 1980, written by Jerry Conway, plot, J.M. DeMatteis on script, with art by Jimmy Janes. Synopsis, another hero leaves the Legion.
Last time we left our intrepid heroes, the entire island of Schmigadoon disappeared from the future, taking Tyrock and Shadow Lass and Dawnstar with it, never for the three of them to be heard from ever again.
Again.
Until this issue.
Right, and you know that's wrong. It's Marzal. Schmigadoon is something entirely schmifferent.
Yeah, so, you know, they call this out in the last time, the Brigadoon Syndrome, right? And so I was going through... And of course, we can look at, and I think we mentioned this a little bit, the 1947 musical Brigadoon, which tells the story of a couple of guys who are traipsing through the Scottish Highlands, and they stumble across a town, Brigadoon, that only appears once every 100 years. It appears for one day, and then at the end of that day, it disappears into the mists once again, not to be seen for 100 years. And so it's one of the guys falls in love with the girl, and the other guy's like, no, let's just get out of here. And this whole love conquers all thing. But then if you go back and you look a little bit more, there is this German tale called Germanschlossen, which tells the story. It's a story from 1860, so almost 100 years prior to the Brigadoon musical, that is about an artist who stumbles upon this German town that appears once for one day every 100 years. And then he falls in love with one of the girls, but he in that story gets away before he becomes part of the town. In this case, Germanschlossen, the city actually sinks down into the ground. It doesn't just disappear. It sinks down into the ground.
How
where
is that
they are
spelled?
Entombed. Germanschlossen. Germanschlossen.
You sure that's not Germanschlossen?
That's what I said. It's very interesting that, you know, we see this happening with Marzal. There was a revival of Brigadoon in the, I want to say the 60s after its big first run on Broadway. And then, of course, the film, which we talked about before.
Right. The version that I know actually stars Robert Goulet and Columbo. It used to air like on the weekend. I want to say it was on like WGN. But yeah, Robert Goulet. That was nice.
Yeah. The musical one that I have seen is Gene Kelly.
The Gene Kelly version.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the 1954 version. And then, of course, I say Schmigadoon because right now on Apple TV, there is a series called Schmigadoon, which is basically this couple stumbles upon this imaginary town that disappears, you know, once, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it's playing on the tropes of the musical, like, you know, one of them will say, oh man, I sure like these biscuits. And then there's a whole musical number about biscuits, and the man is just like, oh, come on, knock it off. We know what's going on here. So there's that as well. So, it's interesting that we see Marzal, fall into the fate of this. And in this case, Marzal disappears for 1,000 years and comes back for 30 years.
Right.
Which,
except when somebody steals all the magic.
Well, we don't know anything about that. I mean, that may be something that comes up.
That's what Tyrok says in this issue. He believes that Marzal is leaving early because his voice powers are stealing all the magic.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And I'm not sure. There's a couple. I think there's a lot of problems with this issue. Mm-hmm. In their attempt to try to give some backstory to Tyrok, which I think is fine.
Right.
But also, I think they, from today's lens, and that's kind of how we look at these issues.
Right.
Man, people would be burning Jerry Conway and JM DeMatteis and Jimmy Janes. They'd be throwing bricks at them and trying to hang them in effigy and maybe burn their houses down.
I don't know. I mean, the part of the book that is the hardest to read for me is a relatively sanitized, but mostly accurate look at the actual process of slavery. And, you know, how it took place, you know, centuries before 17th century, I think it is 200 years. Well,
yes, including the giant Swedish guy with the blonde hair and the Nordic
dread
mustache.
Pirate Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, it kind of gets a little heavy handed when it's just like, yes, it's the blonde eyed or the blue eyed, blonde haired white devil that has done this to everyone. That, you know, I can understand the point that they're getting across. Slavery is bad. And yes, it is. But in the process, it also confuses the history that we've been told about Tyrok.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the future, we always ask the question, what has happened to all of the people of color? Everyone that we see on Earth is always white. There are no black people. And of course, we know the answer. And that is the editor at DC Comics at the time was racist and didn't like black people in his comics. And so he forbid them. But in the story that we've been told, it's that, oh no, all the black people just got fed up and decided to go live on this island, which isn't right. necessarily true either, because when did they all get up and leave and move to this island? Has it just been in the last 30 years that they've done this? Because I don't think there's enough time for that mass migration to happen, because what ends up happening in the story is there's a mutiny of the would-be slaves on the ship, and they crash onto this island, which they're only there for maybe a couple of days. It may be a year, but then they disappear and they're not seen again for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have only got really a chance to do this maybe 3 or 4 times. And I don't think that everyone's just sitting around anticipating this island coming back and then all of the black people on the planet saying, well, yes, let's all go move to this little tiny island.
Yeah, they have definitely retconned out anything related to all of the black people going to the island. And honestly, I'm fine with that, because that's a terrible plot point. But, you know, this story dates the actual founding of Marzal to the 17th century, the 1600s, or 1400 years before the 30th century when it's being told. So obviously, you know, all of the African Americans and all of the black people did not leave the world in the 17th century, never to return.
Right.
So I like that, honestly. I mean, you look at this story and you see what the future Marzalians go through, led by Tyrok's ancestor, Stabala. I think that's how one would pronounce it. And you almost understand why they want to their separatism, why they want to have their own island and live away from all of the other people.
And I'm not sure. Well, again, they really don't know the rest of the world, right? Because it's like once in a generation or once every 3 generations does someone get to experience the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's not, you know, I know when we first met Tyrok, it was, you know, leave the black man alone. We want to be left alone on our own island, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't seem to be what we see play out in this in this issue. It's basically, hey, we've been shut away, and when we come back, we do our thing, and then we go away again. If people even find us, because we're an island in the middle of the Atlantic, one presumes. So yeah, it's really, first of all, the whole idea that that the black community or the black people want to segregate themselves from the rest of the world also is super problematic, because that's like a white supremacist wet dream, right?
Right.
So that's in itself is problematic right there. Then there's other things that are just assumed that are very, also very weird. Like, I can understand that a culture would have its own industrial age. Mm-hmm. That seems fairly likely in what is going on. But there's a couple of panels where all the people on Marzal are wearing Victorian garb. Mm-hmm. And their houses look like little Victorian houses.
Right.
And I'm
basically, it's supposed to represent the 19th century with perfect parallel evolution to what we would have seen.
That's the part that doesn't fit with me, because again, that's very white of you to be thinking that way. And it's unfortunate too, because this could have been a moment in this comic where we could have introduced, and I don't know exactly when the concept of Afrofuturism was introduced. Mm-hmm. The information that I was finding says like in the 1990s is when the concept was first introduced or first coined to talk about what would happen for black characters who are advancing in their own future and not being influenced by others. Mm-hmm. And this would have been a perfect moment. I mean, could you see Marzal coming back and it's like Wakanda or better than Wakanda in that kind of a sense? And it seems that to kind of parallel what's going on in European, white European modality on Marzal while it's locked away in this other dimension is also very troubling.
It is, but I also feel like part of the thing here, and part of what is hard to parse, is this story is meant to, I believe TV Tropes would call it, develop doomed characters, in the sense that Marzal represents part of the story, because this is clearly writing Tyrok and Marzal out of Legion reality.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, to do this whole backstory and to really overtly, you know, attack this concept of racism and to try and make sense of what we've been told about Marzal's founding. On the one hand, I'm fine with that. I feel like that's actually kind of a noble pursuit. And I don't necessarily think that they were looking at any of the, you know, possible implications, because they're getting ready to get rid of the concept, basically.
Right. That, and also it's 1980 at this time, but you know, there's still a lot of blaxploitation and racism that was still very, I don't want to say like, maybe I should say casual racism, mm-hmm. that people just don't think about, that feels very prevalent in this issue.
Yeah.
And I think, granted, as they're trying to tell this story and as they're trying to develop these characters, I don't have a problem with that, except A, they confuse their own origin story, or they're retconning their own origin story of a character who's been seen probably less than a dozen times at this point. And then they're also throwing in the socially uncomfortable moments of casual racism that's there.
I think that to some degree, the racism that we're seeing here is kind of a reflection of 70s pop culture and the way, you know, the way it reflects a black experience. But, you know, it's worth noting that the creative team on this issue has no black people. And, you know, honestly, neither does the host of this show. So, you know, we definitely have a perception of what's going on in here, and we can look at it and say, this definitely could have been done better. But as we've seen before, you know, when we tried to write off Tyrok previously, we actually got letters from people listening mm-hmm. to the show who said that they enjoyed the character and felt empowered by him. They liked him as a character. And I feel like definitely there are things here that have not aged well. But this may be the best portrayal of Tyrok and, you know, by extension, the best portrayal of Marzal that we've gotten to date. I mean, he started out as just very much the stereotypical 70s angry large black man.
So there, yes, and so that's the thing that Jim Shooter really hated about Tyrock. You know, he says, quote, "I always wanted to have a character who was African-American, and years later when they did that, they did it in the worst possible way. Instead of just incidentally having a character who happens to be black, they made a big fuss about it. He's a racial separatist. I found it pathetic and appalling." And even Mike Grell would go on to say that Tyrock was sort of a sore spot with me. He said, "I kept getting stalled off, and finally comes Tyrock. They might as well have named him Tyrone. Their explanation for why there are no black people in the Legion was that all black people had gone to live on an island. It's possibly the most racist concept I've ever heard in my life. I mean, it's a segregationist dream, right? So they named him Tyrock and gave him the world's stupidest superpower." That's Mike Grell, the co-creator of Tyrock. And, of course, he calls out Murray Boltonoff as the person who was not allowing people of color into the comics. The other thing that, and so, again, we're looking at this from today's standpoint. Right. And so when we look at this from today's standpoint, if this stuff had been in comics, I think there would be a lot of people up in arms over it. I really think that people would have a big problem. And it doesn't matter the color of the skin. I think a lot of people would call this out for kind of what is the casual racism that I see in this issue. And I think that would be a big deal. But back in July of 1980, when this the cover date on this issue, right, I think it probably really wasn't considered, including the part that at one point when they're walking through the island, I forget who says this, or maybe it's the narrator's block. It says the handsome, dark skinned youth walking in. And that also is problematic because it's fetishizing someone based on the color of their skin.
Right. Yeah. But it's interesting. You know, at first I was looking at this and thinking the choice of Shadowlass and Dawnstar was obviously to get some of the nakedest Legionnaires so Tyrock didn't feel underdressed. Well, but as we've been discussing this, I'm starting to wonder.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it isn't because they're not white, and that's the reason why.
Right.
They're
absolutely
in the issue. Yeah.
Yeah, because Dawnstar is one of the earliest Native Americans in DC Comics. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've gone over the whole Aboriginal, is she Native American or not? But Shadowlass was at one point, according to Shooter, intended to be black, and they couldn't get away with it, so they turned her blue. But it's interesting that these two characters, both of whom come from similar reclusive, you know, backgrounds, both of whom come from, you know, warrior castes, and, you know, Dawnstar's Starhaven was very similar to Marzal in its origins. You know, we've talked about that as well, where, you know, Native Americans or, you know, First Nationers went out and colonized their own planet in a way very similar to Marzal. So I think it there may be more to the choice of these two Legionnaires than I had considered at first.
Yeah, that was my first incarnate. When I sat down after reading this, I was like, oh, this is the reason why they have these two characters specifically. And because they most represent human looking, because if you have Chameleon Boy in there, well, then it's just like, and then
shapeshift into anything. I mean you can't.
So yeah, it's a really bad example of having someone who is not quote unquote white. And then you really couldn't do Brainiac 5 because, you know, he's a blonde haired, blue eyed green guy.
Right. And, you know, also recently a mass murderer.
Yes. Also that.
But, you know, it is worth noting that this issue has Tyrock do, if not the most, very close to the most actual superheroics we ever see him do.
And they do point, the other thing that I found that was really interesting in this is he's a mutant. He has a mutation, and it's not that everybody on Marzal can do the things that he does. Right. He actually has a mutation that is kind of described as maybe being connected to him going to the Phantom Zone whenever they disappear. So, but he's straight up a mutant. He's somebody that has a mutation, not somebody that has gained a power by being thrown into the sun or a microwave, right, or just go into a baseball game when your boss told you to deliver this secret formula, and so you drink down the secret formula. He straight up just has a mutant ability.
Right.
When did what's his name from the X-Men? Not Shriek.
Banshee?
Yeah, Banshee. That's what I'm thinking of.
Banshee originated as a villain, I want to say around 64 or 65. He was part of Factor Three in the early 30s of X-Men. His first appearance may have been like X-Men 18 or 19. I honestly don't remember, but I know it was early 60s. It was still when Werner Roth was drawing the books.
So. Okay. We also kind of learn, I mean, if you, again, Tyrox, I don't know how many appearances he's done before here. I'm going to say a dozen.
15.
Is it 15? So it's
give or take, yeah.
Yeah, so it's around that. But if we really pay attention here, we notice that he starts using different voices, and here in a second, we'll talk about those. But so not only are they expanding upon his power set and making him stronger, but the end of this issue is that they finally figure out that if he screams loud enough, he can rip a hole through space-time. And because of her massive tracking powers, Dawnstar can lead her and Shadow Lass out of the Phantom Zone into the real world.
Whatever zone they're in. It's not the Phantom
Zone. No, it's not, but I'm just using
it's
that as
a Phantom Zone.
It's the Brigadoon Zone.
The Dune Zone. And, you know, the last panel, I'll give them credit, the last panel of this story basically has her saying, and I'm sure we'll see him again. Because they spent that whole issue showing off how he could be a good Legionnaire and how his powers are more useful than you think and how his people aren't as problematic. And then he disappears for 12 years.
Oh, 12 years in comic time?
Yeah, well, Tyrok never appears again.
Right, until he becomes president
time,
of the United States.
After president the Crisis on Infinite Earths. He shows up again in the Volume 4 Legion, which is now an alternate future that
doesn't even exist then.
Happen.
Yeah, so here's the thing. It feels like, I don't know who was editor at the time. Paul Levitz, he's not an editor yet.
No, not Levitz. It would have been Jack Harris, Jack C. Harris.
Okay. So I doubt Harris was like, get rid of this guy. Because he's
he
never really had.
Been. Harris hated Tyrone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Oh, probably the same reason Grell did.
Yeah. Here's
very
the
awkward.
Thing. Get rid of this guy, and then we give him this very interesting backstory, and we expand his powers. But at the same time, the way that they ended the issue, they didn't close the door, right? They basically are saying, hey, if a writer was keen to include Tyrok again, then he's got the power to go through. He's got the touch to get back to Earth and jump back and forth as needed. But apparently no one wanted to touch Tyrok again for 12 years.
Yeah. And you know, the 12 years includes, you know, cause he came back in the 5-year gap.
Right.
And the 5-year gap made a point of taking the characters who were badly treated and badly, you know, maligned by the fans and putting them front and center. The 5-year gap Legion has a big role for Matter Eater Lad. It has big roles for the substitute heroes. You know, it has Invisible Kid and Tyrok in important EarthGov power positions. So yeah, I feel like the biggest takeaway that I have from Legion 265 is that Tyrok could have been a really strong Legionnaire if someone was interested in writing him.
Yeah. And that's probably why so it's not that I don't care for Tyrok. I just don't care for how they've handled him. Right.
Right.
He's supposedly one of this huge power set characters that kind of ranks him up there with Mon-El or Jonah. And yet he's relegated to this part that nobody wants to touch with a 10-foot pole. And we've talked before that, you know, there was this belief, a misguided belief, that if you have black characters in your movies, in your TV shows, in your comic books, that it would hurt sales specifically in the South. And that stuff was never proven to be accurate. And it just feels like everybody's like, no, I don't want to deal with Tyrok. Let's do something dumb with him. Or let's just kind of push him away with a wave of our hand as we write his tales. And so he just comes off as ineffective and as in his original creation, the angry young black man that just stereotypes him even further. So it just seems like they pile stereotype upon stereotype on Tyrok. And every time they try to dismantle it, they kind of make the situation worse.
They do.
And I think that's why I just don't care for Thai rock.
Part of it is the 70s. I mean, DC was way behind Marvel. Thai rock is
the first, depending, second?
First, depending on how you count it, because you do have to look at DC Lobo. Has black characters. DC had Jackie Johnson in Easy Company, Dr. August Durant, the leader of the original Secret Six, Mal Duncan of the Teen Titans. But before Thai rock, none of them were costumed heroes. After Thai rock, we get Mal turning into the Hornblower or the Guardian, whatever the hell he is. You get the Bumblebee, you get Vixen, you get Black Lightning. Mm-hmm. All after Thai rock. So when you really look at it, Thai rock for me always falls into that that Charles Austenson part of "For the Record, We Tried." You know, it was an attempt to create a character, but in the attempt, there were so many missteps, and everything that they tried to do to fix it just made it worse.
Yeah. But didn't Black Lightning come out like a year after?
Black Lightning came out in 77. Thai rock came out in April of 76.
Okay.
Bumblebee became a superhero in like December of 76 in an issue of Teen Titans.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vixen appeared, I think, in DC Comics Presents in 78 or 78.
I would really love to be in a fly on the wall in an editor's meeting when they're discussing Thai rock and Black Lightning at the same time to just find out why Black Lightning is a character that was able to very quickly rise in the, you know, in the realm of DC superheroes. But then Thai rock was just like this guy who nobody cares about. I mean, what is it? He was even, Grell mentions that he modeled Thai rock on football player Fred Williamson, which you'd think would also be a big attractor to comic book readers or to fans. But it just feels like every step of the way, they're just like somebody was, I honestly believe somebody's internally sabotaging Thai rock from the beginning.
It's possible. And remember, you know, the story about Black Lightning is that Tony Isabella was either tapped to write the book or volunteered to write the book. The original concept was the Brown Bomber, which was a white racist Vietnam veteran who said the word black power and was transformed into a superpowered black man.
Right.
And people at DC thought this would be a great way to address, you know, basically the black condition in the 1970s. And Isabella, reputedly, by his telling and by others, went in and said, "You can't do this, guys. This is crazy. Here's this concept that I have." And then I feel like Isabella loving and really injecting as much, you know, feeling and heart into those 11 issues of Black Lightning as he could makes all the difference. If the creator believes in it.
Yeah.
And there are parts of Black Lightning's early story that are as stereotypical as we see with Tyrone. Yeah. But you also do have the point that Tyrock's own creators both agree that he's not their best work. I mean, Grell flat out said, "I hate him." Carrie Bates, you know, has been quoted as saying, "Yeah, it didn't work out." But, you know, Bates was also the one who really wanted, the last one, I feel, who really wanted to do something with Tyrock. And then after Tyrock arrived, Bates was no longer writing the Legion. So,
yeah. Ish. Well, Thai rock, it was fun while it lasted.
If you enjoy the show, we would appreciate your support. You can find out more and become a Legion Clubhouse member at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
Oh, but before we get away with Thai rock, let's talk about some of his crazy powers. So this past issue was the one where we really start to see a bunch of powers that he appears to possess. So there's two different sources that you can look at this. They're very similar to one another. The first is the Legion of Super Bloggers. They have EO, which opens a portal. That's the one that they use to open a portal here. Then they have EA, which also opens a portal. And then they have Rueya, which creates a cloud for people to land safely on. That happened in this issue. Then you have Yai, which teleports you. And then you have OU, which also teleports you. And then you have IE, which also teleports you.
Yeah.
And then you have Ia, which calls forth Cthulhu from the realms. No, but yeah, you have something. What's that?
You're thinking of something different.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Cthulhu.
It's a movie.
Ia is causing things to burst into flames. Mm-hmm. And then you got Urga.
Reek.
Which is a force field bubbles. Mm-hmm. And then you have R for talk like a pirate day.
No, that's other. That's detecting force fields or deflective force fields.
Defective force fields. And then you have.
Not defective, deflective.
You have UAG, where you send someone into the sun, apparently. Which I don't know why. If I were Tyrock, the minute that Brigadoon popped back into existence, I'd just start screaming that left and right.
Just. You know, and every time you meet up with a persuader, fire him into the sun.
Yeah, like every time Wildfire starts pissing you off, you just scream that at him. And then you have R causes things to explode. Arr. And then you have Zaraga, which makes you spin uncontrollably. Although this is where things differ because Wikipedia says Zaraga is telekinesis.
Mm.
And so I don't know. I guess we only saw the one time that Zaraga was used and it was to spin somebody around uncontrollably.
Right. I feel like Wikipedia is kind of generalizing there. Mm-hmm. When it comes to nerdery, I'm going to go with the super bloggers over the wiki.
Yeah. And then you have UE.
That's pronounced OE,
which causes vertigo.
And jungle love.
And then you have Arig, which will rain plastic. Rain. But again, Wikipedia says weather manipulation.
Right.
So, I mean, it's the same thing, but weather. Yeah. And then you have Urwu, which causes vegetation to grow. And Wikipedia says that's plant manipulation.
Makes sense.
Then you've got Sir, which lose your balance. Also, or causes vertigo, again, whichever one you want to go with. And then Rai, which causes hurricane winds, which I think if the creators really wanted to have fun, then if you wanted to create hurricane winds, it really should have been Furt.
No. What's wrong with you?
Legion of Superheroes, number 266, Cantu. Published August 1980. Written by Jerry Conway with art by Jimmy Janes. Synopsis. Two legionnaires release an ancient demon, and all hell breaks loose.
All right, we are completely finished with Tyrock, apparently, so we might as well move on to the story of Cantu, which is a bouncing boy duo damsel story, which I thought when bouncing boy and duo damsel went to the planet Wiki-9 or whatever it is.
It's pronounced Wundelix.
Yeah, 1D9. 1D9. Yeah. I thought that they were just there for a little bit. I didn't think that they wanted to stick around and be part of the society building on that planet.
It wasn't clear in that first story. It definitely implied that they were there to kind of shepherd the
dum-dums,
the group. Yeah, but that's been 30 issues ago now, maybe more.
No, it can't be 30 issues.
Yeah, it would have been, well, not 30.
It probably was like, what was over
it?
A year.
It was like 255, 254.
Yeah, so it would have been somewhere a year before, yeah.
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
Anyway, this whole story is bouncing boy doesn't know how to push the right buttons, and he causes everything to explode, and then he gets to make out with duo damsel. And then, of course, we discover that they've unleashed a djinn.
A djinn, yes.
And then they have to figure out a way to get him back in his bottle. But apparently this djinn does not want to go back in the bottle. He's got great cosmic power, and he doesn't want to go back into that itty bitty living space. And so we end up with a cliffhanger because the djinn is going back to Earth to take out his master who doesn't exist anymore.
It's not really clear, honestly. I mean, it's not going to be clear after we've read the whole story, but it's not really clear in this issue what he's up to.
Yeah.
I think that this is once again, you know, I complained about this during the circus arc. This is once again a really bizarre premise to stick in a science fiction, you know, slash superhero.
Well, yeah, this could even go back to the Christmas issue that we did a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea that djinns and genies come from space somehow.
Well, no, because
were sent into space. I don't.
Yeah, that's the implication, is that this genie was on Earth and somehow it got sent away into space, and now it's only been unleashed, and now it's coming back to seek its revenge. And again, yeah. I would agree with you that it feels a little weird because you're mixing this sci-fi and this fantasy together, although we've seen that in the past with, you know, Princess Projectra is all about those two things that shouldn't exist together. But I'm also
related to Mordru too, but
yeah, I'm also very concerned a little bit that we have kind of a character from Muslim religion here that's being basically dismissed as hokum.
Ah, but keep in mind, it's a character from Muslim religion being overtly dismissed by a character who is canonically Jewish.
Yeah, but still,
on the one hand, could give you an explanation for why Jim immediately says it's hokum.
Wants to dismiss it. Yeah.
But it also, you know, kind of leans really hard on the question that you probably shouldn't ask there. So, I don't know. I feel like...
I mean, I don't have any problems with genies or djinns or anything like that. Right. And that's fine.
You know, mythologically speaking, I don't
think... Right, if you wanted to go mythological.
I don't think it's any more offensive than, you know, calling a character the White Witch or having Mordru, you know, overtly being a warlock. You do have, you know, lots of different sort of histories and mythologies and, you know, stories kind of tying into each other.
I think the problem, though, is... And I don't know the entire mythological background of djinns, but they're portrayed as bad guys. And same way, and I would have a feeling that maybe people who are Wiccans might have a problem with the fact that Mordru is portrayed as a bad guy.
Sure.
So I don't know.
You know, it's not necessarily a bad call, but it's also something that in 1960 or 1980 even,
yeah,
you know, having a character be a literal genie. Which I think, if I'm not mistaken, may be an Arabic word for what we would call a demon.
Yeah.
You know, to have that character pop up, it's not necessarily based on any type of real mythology. It's based on, you know, Aladdin.
Yeah, it's Aladdin and his
Thousand and One Nights. Have been translated into the English. But once again, such a weird concept for the Legion to fight, this massive creature of magic who punches the Legion cruiser.
Yeah.
Who, you know, throws Element Lad, and by the way, throws Element Lad to his inevitable doom at the side of the ship. So Colossal Boy,
oh yeah,
jumps in the way. Colossal Boy, wearing a full steel belt and his disco bondage harness, deflects him as though hitting a 60-foot man covered in steel is somehow going to be less neck-breaking than hitting the side of the ship. It's like when, you know, the thing is like, oh my God, he's falling onto the pavement. I'd better catch him.
Yeah.
What's the difference, the thing?
Yeah. I also got a kick out of the fact that the two are trying to have some kind of a muscle man competition in the gym together, Element Lad and Colossal Boy. And it's like, okay, I see where this is going.
It's cool.
So here's the thing.
It's nice to see Element Lad. I don't think we've seen Element Lad in like a year and a half.
Yeah, and then he'll go away until he becomes president of the United States or of the Federation. So here's the thing
leader.
That I started thinking about. So Bouncing Boy, Chuck Tane, you know, he gets big. He blows Charles up into the Foster size. Yeah. He blows up into a big round sphere. So everybody just assumes that Chuck is a large person, is a fat person, right?
Yes.
But, you know, and again, when we saw him in his early incarnations, he had a nice big spare tire around his middle. But as we've seen him more recently, he's still big, but he's not as tubby as we've seen him before. I have a feeling
what the girls today would call a chonky boy.
Yeah, yeah. I have a feeling that Chuck is probably only about 185 pounds or so.
Okay, show your work.
Well, the problem is the depiction of fat people in media and what we think of fat has drastically changed over the years. And part of that has to do with the fact that our bodies have gotten bigger over the years.
The population has expanded.
Yeah, so for example, when we think of the Three Stooges and we think of Curly, we right. think of someone who is, oh, he was the fat person of the Stooges. But if you go and look, and I stumbled across a bunch of Three Stooges films that are up on YouTube, mm-hmm. he's relatively thin. I mean, he was 175 pounds at 5'5", which I know is still, by today's standards, obese. But when you see him next to his brother or next to other people in those films, he's mm-hmm. not as fat as media would portray him as, or what we in our minds think it as. And unfortunately, I think that when we look at how media portrays people who are overweight or large, I think it's really a negative connotation that comes with that. And I don't know if the slimming down of Chuck in the comics, mm-hmm. I don't think would be a result of somebody having a mind change on how he should be portrayed, because this is the time when we have, you know, Weird Al is about to come out with his fat album. We've got those two guys in the checker pants riding around on the mopeds in the movies.
The Fat Boys?
Yeah.
They come around about 86, 87.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, we're not in a time where you would be like, oh, man, I think we shouldn't be portraying fat people, you know, as just over, you know, super overweight people. Sure. So I just find that interesting, that I think when we think of Chuck Tane as someone who is just like this incredibly fat person, you go back and look at it, he's really not. And when we think of Curly Joe, or not Curly Joe, but Curly Howard, mm-hmm. as being this ridiculously overweight guy, mm-hmm. he really wasn't.
Okay. First and foremost, I don't think of either of them as extremely fat, but I will grant you your point. And I'll go one further.
Okay.
Because you, Stephen, you're the guy with the thoughts. You're the guy with the ideas and the musings and the wonderings. I'm the continuity guy. So, according to DC Comics' official 1985 continuity guide, who's who in the Legion of Superheroes,
or 1985.
Excuse me, who's okay. who in the DC Universe,
yeah.
the deluxe directory, Charles Foster Tane, 5'8" tall,
mm-hmm.
221 pounds.
There's no way.
221
not,
pounds.
Not and in the way that they draw him here. He's must have a lot of dense muscle underneath that, because there is no way that the way that they draw him in the last couple of appearances that we've seen him, there is no way that he is, what'd you say, 5'8"?
5'8".
And 220.
225.
Give or no take. Way. No way. He's well, 180. He's got to be, in the way that they draw him, 185. Now, the problem with that, of course, is
mm-hmm.
most of the artists, when they're drawing comic book characters, are drawing good looking people all day. You know, the slim super athlete, what we think of as the Superman character. So maybe getting them to think of someone who is, you know, overweight without making them, you know,
rotund or grotesque.
Yeah, grotesquely overweight. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what I'm seeing here. But when I'm looking at Chuck, I'm like, you know, he does not look like somebody who is super overweight.
Okay. So going to 1989,
mm-hmm.
Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes number one, Charles Foster Tane has gained a bit of weight.
Oh my God.
But at that point, 5'8" tall, 231 pounds.
No way.
Yep. Now here's the thing though. When you see Chuck, he's usually drawn as just a chunky dude.
Yeah.
But when he inflates.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's when he gets,
you know, he's not made of rubber. He's not an inflated balloon. Whatever his mass is made of when he bounces out is clearly powerful, is clearly dense, is clearly durable.
Yeah.
I would argue that Chuck is just a chunky guy, but somehow he's drawing on some sort of extra dimensional mass when he blows up into his bouncing form.
I don't know about that, but okay.
And the bouncing, I mean, we've seen his bouncing form
do you think essentially
indestructible.
Do you think that they're counting his weight as his inflated size?
I don't know. I would say probably not. Because, I mean, it's honestly hard to say. You have to keep in mind that comic book weights are ridiculous and stupid.
Yes.
It's
like Superman is like 300 pounds or something like that.
By comparison, Brainiac is 5'10"
yeah.
and 160 pounds.
That's a chameleon boy. That is so, just so you know, Matthew, because we can get into a whole height weight ratio thing.
No,
according to the U.S. government, when you are 5'10", you should be 150 or 160. Okay. So Brainiac is what the quote unquote government says that you should be, right? For the average person.
So if we look at Colossal Boy.
Yeah.
Colossal Boy, muscular, thick, broad shouldered, 6'2", 200 pounds.
That would be about right.
At his normal weight. Colossal Boy, 6 foot even, about 190 pounds. So you look at that and you say that 221 means that, you know, Chuck is about 25 pounds overweight based on the other legionnaires. If you look at the women, it's
But you have to go by the height too, right?
So sure. Dawnstar is 5'6" and 119 pounds. That's dumb.
Yeah, see, so that's just dumb. There's just no way. There's just no way. Listeners, I want you guys to weigh in.
Wings weigh 119 pounds.
They would have to. I mean, she's got to weigh like 90 pounds in order to lift her up. But listeners, we want you to write in. Are weight depictions in comics just overly blown and not correct? Do the artists not have a real conceptual idea of what someone like what they think of as Chuck should be? Or not? I want to know. I mean, what's his name over there on the X-Men's? Blob? What's his name?
Frederick J. Dukes, the Blob.
Yeah, the Blob. You know, how much does that guy weigh? I'm curious. I'm just really curious because I have a feeling that just in the way that our mind shifts things and the way that we perceive things, that we think of people to be bigger than they actually are. That's what I guess I'm getting at.
Blob is a bad example because Blob is very, very large, but Blob is also, I mean, his power is being fat.
Right. Right.
Which is just dumb. Yeah. But at the point that, you know, Blob is in his non-modified form. So not when he was 8 feet tall, thanks to Rob Liefeld.
Yeah.
Blob is 5'10".
Yeah.
500 pounds, 510 pounds, according to the Marvel wiki.
Hmm.
So,
all right, listeners,
500 pounds.
That would be really heavy.
But it'd be 2 inches shorter than me and, you know, probably 120 pounds on me. So not 120 pounds, 70 pounds on me. But still, you still have to ask yourself, is the Blob that we see, the grotesquely fat Blob, is it realistic to say 500 pounds, or is that just a number that they pulled out of their head as,
that's
is fat.
Listeners, please write to us and let us know on this. I'm very curious to know. I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to figure out, okay, why do people think of someone, Chuck? And again, 20 pounds, the doctor would certainly start chastising you if you were over 20 pounds. But I think today most doctors would say, hey, man, maybe just go walk a little bit and maybe have a salad once a week and you'll be fine.
30 minutes of exercise, get your heart pumping 2 or 3 times a week is what they'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah. But 20 pounds over, they wouldn't be like, oh, you're like the fattest person I've ever seen kind of thing. But the way that we think of Curly or Chuck or the Blob, we think of them as these grotesquely overweight people. And I don't think that they are. So let us know, listeners. podcast@majorspoilers.com. All right. We have reached the end of another Legion Clubhouse, Matthew. I know, super controversial. I think some people really don't like when we go off on a tangent like this. And some people really, really dig it, which is fine. Maybe sometimes when we go off into these weird tangents, it gives people time to pause and think about stuff. But what are some things that we paused and thought about this week?
I think this week I learned that you and I have very different ideas of what is really, really fat.
I think we also learned that Brigadoon is probably a borrowed idea that Marzal was then borrowed from once again.
And we learned that Chuck and Lornu don't want to be Legionnaires, but they sure put a lot of effort into making sure their snowsuits look just like their superhero suits.
That's right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us this week. If you do have any questions, just pop us an email, podcast@majorspoilers.com. We certainly would love to hear from you. If you would, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers, and we will be back for another exciting, oh man, we got to find out what happens to this gin in our next Legion Clubhouse. So until then, I'm Alec.
And I'm 30 Stone Boy.
The Legion Clubhouse is a production of Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC, and is produced by Steven Schleicher. Your hosts were Matthew Peterson and Steven Schleicher. You can follow Matthew at Mighty King Cobra and Steven at Major Spoilers. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Legion Clubhouse. If you have questions or comments, send them to podcast@majorspoilers.com. I'm Jason Inman. Until next time, eat it, Grandpa.
This podcast is copyright 2021 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.